Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we explore treasury best practices during global expansions with Sue Karas. Sue is the managing director and head of global commercial banking within the Global Transaction Services at Bank of America. In this episode, we discuss the key treasury decisions to consider when expanding internationally, best practices in cash management, FX and regulatory navigation, how tools like CashPro forecasting and intelligent receivables powered by machine learning are automating treasury operations, and how global expansions present both unique challenges and exciting opportunities for treasurers. And of course, like always, much, much more. Let's face it, most people end up in treasury by accident, and then they end up loving it, of course. I loved my episode with Sue because we see and we feel that she's truly passionate about her craft, about what she does, and how she helps corporate with their treasury operations. And it was really an enlightening and refreshing conversation. I hope you will enjoy it as much as I did. Before we get in, a quick message. We've been doing this podcast for 2.5 years now, and the most listened to episodes are always the ones talking about career and certifications in treasury, because it matters. So we decided to partner up with the AFP, the Association for Financial Professionals, so we can offer you a $100 discount code on all the AFP's products. This includes, of course, the CTP, the Certified Treasury Professional, which is hands down the most renowned and recognized certification in treasury out there. And with all that being said, please welcome Sue Karas. Suzanne, welcome to Corporate Treasury 101. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff today. So let's maybe start with the beginning and define some terms. What defines a middle market company in BOFA's terms?
Middle market companies at Bank of America are defined as multinational companies with annual revenue between $50 million and $2 billion. That segment of companies is served by our global commercial banking division, which provides a wide range of financial services, treasury, credit, leasing, advisory. I will comment that if we think about middle market in the standard industry definition, it's slightly narrower than that. Most middle market companies are defined as $10 million to about $1 billion. But our threshold at Bank of America really puts a reflection on that focus of the higher end and the more complex multinationals as we think about going to market with the power of our advice.
I'm a bit curious, $50 million. So from my experience, right, you start developing a corporate treasury department as of a few hundred millions per year, because otherwise it's such a niche department that it's not always justified. How do you typically approach this with companies that are closer to the $50 million a year in revenue versus obviously the $2 billion where it would absolutely make sense to have a treasurer? How do you manage that relationship from a treasury standpoint for smaller companies?
It's interesting because if you think about multinationals in general, the larger the multinational, what we tend to find is the larger their treasury departments, the more advice that they have access to. They have access to consultants. They might have treasury teams that are hundreds of people. When we think about treasury departments on the smaller end of the curve, right, maybe newer in their business origin, that's where the quality of advice really comes in. Because we become an extension of the treasury team. We're able to help them think through industry-leading best practices and how they should be thinking about going to market. And our advice plays a really pivotal role in their life cycle and their journey as they go to market.
Speaking about helping and advising those companies all the way up to $2 billion in revenues, when we look at internationalization, right, what are the first treasury decisions that treasury departments need to make or be advised on when expanding internationally in your experience?
The first is how you want to approach international markets, right? You can start with just tipping your toe into international markets. That could be selling outside of the U.S. It could be sourcing materials outside of the U.S., That cross-border relationship is usually the initial start. Then you evolve into what would your business look like if you were to set up operations outside of the US? You might do that organically through an expansion into a new market, or I will say, in the spirit of dipping your toe in the water, sometimes it feels like you've jumped into the deep end of the pool when you make a very large strategic acquisition, and all of a sudden, overnight, you're operating in global markets.
Can I get back to how you might want to approach, right, the internationalization, and depending on what direction the company is taking? Maybe to set the foundation, like, what would best-in-class cash management looks like when scaling internationally, regardless of the approach, but just to make sure you have a base that is going to be able to help the business in the right direction?
All right. The very first thing you need to do is you need to think about, from a strategic planning standpoint, what does the business need from a control and from a governance process? So it could be that you think about banking infrastructure and account strategy. How do you want to set up your accounts? Do you want those accounts to be in local currency? Do you want the accounts to be in US dollars? But the account structure is really what dictates the movement of money around the world. After that, when you think about leading advancements or best practices, it's really about your FX strategy and where are you thinking about identifying currency exposure around the world. How do you proactively identify all of the transactional flows and thinking through things such as, do I want to naturally hedge this exposure or do I want to implement more forward-thinking FX contracts? Liquidity, critically important to any organization. And how do you think about visibility of that cash around the world? And then finally, the world is a really complex place. So from a regulatory standpoint, do you fully understand what it means to do business in that jurisdiction? Every country is different. But if you focus on the core of what's happening in the US, you provide those industry best practices, things like straight-through processing, tight governance around money movement, ensuring you have visibility and control. Your permissions and authorities are set correctly at headquarters. Doing all of that as the initial preliminary step, it always makes expansion outside of the US borders much easier.
Let's say harder countries to establish business in from a treasury standpoint. How do you recommend, you know, looking at local regulation, you mentioned it, but then the role of the central bank in that particular country, how to manage that relationship with them, if at all? The other thing that I'm thinking is, naturally hedging. So that's two questions in one here, a bit of a challenge for you, curveball for you. So yeah. I hope you're not going to be angry at me. But so there is the role of the central banks. I'm also thinking back to one of the things you mentioned, like, do you want to naturally hedge when you're expanding and potentially tipping your toe? You don't necessarily have enough, you know, volume on both end side of the purchasing and selling to naturally hedge. So is it necessary to put in place an FX strategy here? How do you go about all this?
Regulatory environment outside of the US.
Let's do it.
Or outside of your home jurisdiction. I'm going to put it into fun categories. It's either mild, medium, or spicy hot. And understanding how every country is uniquely different is critically important to your success. I will give you a few examples and then I'll tie into this natural hedging piece. So we have jurisdictions around the world, free-flowing currency, limited country regulation, relatively straightforward and moving money around the world. Can think about things like intercompany loans, funding those loans, transfer pricing, and the country governance doesn't necessarily set the regulatory environment. You move into the more moderate to complex jurisdictions and everything changes. So in some jurisdictions, you're not able to access low-value clearing unless you're locally incorporated. In several jurisdictions around the world, you are unable to move money in or out of the country without going through the central bank, which is a somewhat onerous process in making sure that the paperwork is filed correctly, a clear business purpose for moving that money in. And then as you think about the corporate structure, how you're legally incorporated, it changes your ability to, in some cases, even repatriate funds out of that jurisdiction. So in many countries around the world, if you just set up a rep office or a marketing office, you actually can't repatriate those funds. You can only repatriate those funds for a specific corporate purpose. Could be the repayment of an intercompany loan. It could be repatriating as part of a royalty or a dividend payment, but very strict. So understanding the jurisdictional requirements is critical to the success of a corporate. Now that brings me to the point of how do you naturally hedge all this? In most businesses, you will have cash flows that are long or short. It could be that you have a sales office that's generating the cash and a manufacturing division that's drawing on that cash. How do you balance those two? Well, that also gets down to the point of jurisdictional requirements. In some jurisdictions, you can move money and you can create intercompany transfers. Other jurisdictions, those natural hedges, they have to get settled up with periodic cadence. And in many places around the world, you are completely restricted from intercompany lending and borrowing across entities. So understanding that from a hedging standpoint is really important because you want to make sure that those long and short positions, we have the opportunity to settle those when it makes sense from a cash forecasting standpoint.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So let's get into a company that wants to, you know, tip their toe in. What should treasurers keep in mind to ensure a smooth transition and support the business in the best way possible?
So the first thing is thinking about how you want to sell services. I would start with that. It would be natural, and I'll use for purposes of this, a U.S. multinational. It would be natural for a U.S. multinational to think about invoicing in U.S. dollars. Why? That's our home currency. And it makes it easier for the corporate treasury department to minimize FX risk when selling. But it's not a very client-centric strategy because you're passing on that FX risk to the consumer. So thinking through how do you marry that product in a client-friendly way, invoicing in local currency is often a best practice. So how do you do that in practicality? Well, there's a wide range of services that allow you to think about, without a hedging strategy, to really think about locking in a guaranteed FX rate, not a guaranteed rate, meaning the actual conversion rate, but locking in the purchase price of that product with a rate at the time that you sell it, so that when funds are remitted, you are naturally hedging your exposure and you understand the risk at the point of sale, not at the point of collection.
What do you typically recommend when approaching? So I understand it's mainly going to be around FX management, transfer of funds, making sure everything runs smoothly at this level because it's just tipping your toe in. When it comes to coordinating this effort, this FX effort, right, with potentially marketing, sales, obviously procurement as well, treasury, who usually takes the leads? Should it be treasury? Should it not be treasury? How does treasury fit into all this? Like, how do you see best performing teams actually work with other departments when it comes to this?
Collaboration is key. It's not one. Amen. It's not the other. It's everybody. It's everybody coming to the table. Naturally, the sales arm of a corporation is going to want to competitively price their product in an overseas market. And it's the creativity of the treasury team that comes to the table on how to strategically execute to provide the knowledge, the intelligence, and the infrastructure around how a company will be able to execute flawlessly.
What do you typically see? I'm interested into getting your point, your view on this, because when I was doing a project in Latin America, obviously salespeople want to, you know, invoice in local currencies. This is much easier and people can purchase and are much more willing to purchase. Let's say you remove friction when you bill in local currency. But then what it does, especially with more restricted currencies, like certain countries in Latin America and South America can be, it gets trickier for all the process afterwards, especially collection, FX hedging. And you can actually lose so much like FX points and margin that it makes the deal less interesting. So you're like, yeah, we are making a deal, but are we really making the money that we need to be making in this country? This is a rough example, but how do you see treasury teams smoothly carrying this that message? And what works the best in the companies that you're helping out?
I started earlier with understanding FX controls. I think that that's key. When you think about currency exposure, mapping out the currency flows, identifying which currencies you plan to receive, how you plan to pay in the regions, categorizing those exposures, right? Is it a supplier payment? Is it a financial payment? Is it an intercompany loan? Is it a transactional exposure? But mapping out the currencies and really understanding at what point in time they will impact your cash forecast, to me, that's where clients have had the biggest impact.
We move to maybe the heavier internationalization, which is organic expansion, right? What are best practices for treasury teams? What do you typically see, Sue?
All right. The first thing is corporates need to understand their governance approach. So how will they control bank accounts by role? Visibility is essential. If you don't create a bank account infrastructure and strategy that allows for global liquidity, visibility into global liquidity, it will be your shortfalling. Understanding from a governance standpoint, how do you think about the types of accounts? And an operating account, a payroll account, a tax account, what is required in each country? In some countries, you need multiple accounts to actually operate. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you need to think about how do you want those accounts set up in local currency? Second is understanding how you want to tap in the movement of money. Will it happen through a bank portal? Will it happen through your TMS or your ERP system? Also very important. Another key, I think, for corporates to really keep in mind is the industry best practice of straight-through processing. So how are you going to achieve straight-through processing? The fewer people that touch paper and workflow along the way, the better off corporates will be. So I'll stop there. It's also just, you sometimes have to put a 30,000 foot view on your infrastructure. And here is why. When local treasurers, and regardless of what your treasury structure is, right, you can centralize all activities into one location. You can operate in a hub and spoke model where certain activity is managed locally, but with oversight at corporate headquarters. Regardless of how you operate, it is important to keep in mind that local language is critical. So tapping into a bank partner that has accessibility of local language skills and functionality is critical. Tapping into a partner that has the ability to operate globally, that will allow you to expand both organically and through acquisition so your platform becomes scalable. And based on your corporate governance policy, having administrative functions inside of a bank portal allows you to designate control and to give permissions in full compliance with what your policy stipulates and, quite frankly, what you're being audited against, right? You want to be in compliance with that governance policy, whether it's SOX guidelines or whether it is your local policy in region or at corporate headquarters. Having an infrastructure to do that is critically important.
Does having an international network like the one of Bank of America's help those treasury teams during global expansion? Is it because they have this local capacity to speak the same language, or is there more to it as well?
I would say all of the above. When I think about the power of our global franchise, it starts with our people. It starts with our people. And our associates are able to connect corporate headquarters with their subsidiaries around the world, understanding central bank policies and governance and what is required in the jurisdiction in which you're operating is essential to success. As you make your way around the world, every central bank operates in a truly unique way that is intended to provide infrastructure to their local economy. If you are doing business in China, as an example, you would have to work very closely with the SAFE administration that governs FX exposure. You would have to apply to the central bank to repatriate funds. Very similar in India, in moving money in or out of the country would require permission and approval from the Royal Bank of India. And similarly, in Latin America, many of those jurisdictions, especially Brazil, have very strict guidelines around the FX movement of funds into Brazil and also the taxation of those dollars as they move out. And regardless of the jurisdiction that we operate in, sit down with the local team to really understand the nuances of the business. The power of Bank of America is a global platform with locally relevant solutions. And because every company operates in a truly unique way, having our people align with the local treasury team to understand how do you do business today and how can we improve upon that? How can we make you more efficient? How can we help you save cost? How can we help you streamline your workflow? I can think of hundreds of examples where that local engagement on the ground and our ability to share that information with corporate headquarters has helped them demystify what their company is doing around the world. And it's that knowledge transfer that's really important. So it starts with people, and then it carries forward to a platform like CashPro, where you have full global visibility. You can operate in, 11 languages around the world. And that gives you this network and connectivity where corporate can see what's happening at a subsidiary level, but subsidiaries can continue to operate like they are with a local bank.
I love that. And that all does make a lot of sense. So let's get back to CashPro in a little while. Before that, what I'd like to ask you is the nitty-gritty. So we've talked about, tipping your toe, organic expansion. How about merger and acquisitions? How do treasury teams can best support their businesses when it comes to developing internationally through M&A?
Well, this would be the jumping in the deep end of the pool. And as we think about jumping in the deep end of the pool, you can start early. You can be planning for this all along. But when that moment actually comes and the CFO walks into your office and says, oh, by the way, we're buying this company and now we're going to be operating in 10 jurisdictions across Europe, the first thing that you need to do is to be well informed. What does that mean? And if I look at Europe as an example, operating in Europe means that you've established a trade registry. The trade registry outlines all of the corporate governance. It tells you who's able to open bank accounts and close bank accounts. What happens in the case of bankruptcy? When you acquire a company, the first thing that you need to be thinking about is what are the legal requirements of doing business in that jurisdiction? And how do we make sure that our trade registries and our bank accounts reflect the new ownership? We haven't talked about KYC yet, but that's a big part of this. And any company that decides to do business both in their home country and outside, they really need to get accustomed to what are the international KYC requirements because they vary by jurisdiction. And I often say to companies that are thinking about doing business outside of their home headquarters, you should be having robust conversations with everybody that you hire into the company as a new hire, that it is expected if you're a signer on the bank account, you will have to present a government ID. And in many jurisdictions, you will have to show proof of residential address. And that just needs to be part of the hiring process. So people aren't surprised when that acquisition happens that they all of a sudden are going to be turning over personal information as well as their corporate information.
I can double down on this. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the name still, but so let's say top three tech company in the world. I used to work for them when I was a consultant at PwC, and we were expanding into complicated jurisdictions. And this very specific aspect of the business, developing, being very well aware of what is currently going in terms of regulations, how we do business there, how we manage funds, was such a headache. But then once you crack it, you're able to really support the business and accompany it. And you have the business telling you, hey, I want to, you know, we are going into this country and make it happen. And when they arrive, the bank accounts are open, we can start doing business, cash flows are going. And it's like, this is where treasury is a support function. Let's say it can be strategic, but it is a support function. And when you unlock this by doing the nitty-gritty that comes into this type of work, this is where you see value for your work. The question I'd like to ask you, Sue, is when it comes to M&A, right, we think about people, obviously. How do centers of excellence play a role into treasury and finance transformation, especially in an M&A context, in an international expansion? So this is niche, but like, how do you see best performing team approaching this very point?
Well, the first thing I would say is when it comes to mergers and acquisition, the first thing that the acquiring company should do is to just transfer knowledge. Understanding the operations is critical to the success, and that transfer of knowledge is really important. I'm of the opinion that there are multiple different ways that you can organize your treasury structure. You can concentrate everything at headquarters. When you do so, there is a risk element of missing out on the local nuances of what it means to do business in that particular country. And so you need to have this collaboration between subsidiaries, whether they're acquired, whether they happen organically, and HQ. And from a talent standpoint, that is essential to the success. No one knows the business on the ground better than the people that have been aligned to that business, in many cases, since inception. So I don't think that there is a necessarily best practice. Every company is going to approach a merger and acquisition differently, but the talent piece is really important. And not taking anything for granted is essential.
So maybe getting into the details of this, but how do you get the buy-ins of the right people in such context? To go back to the example you mentioned earlier, right? Oh, we just acquired this company. Now we're going to be present in, you know, 10 jurisdictions in Europe. This is a lot of people. I'm talking about also the leadership, right? And the stakeholders. How do you get the buy-in of like, hey, we are doing this because this company is developing. We're going to work together in this M&A context. How do you actually get the buy-in of all the people involved? We talked about collaboration, right, and transfer of knowledge. So the collaboration of the treasury teams, but potentially even sales, procurement, marketing, all the departments that we often have to deal with to do proper business.
Well, there's one way to do it. And then I would say there are other ways of taking this approach, which is this is always the way we've done it. So I think, you know, in many cases, just in life in general, you can say, this is the way we do business. This is the best way to do it. And we will continue to do it in this approach. Maybe not the best tact. I think when it comes to a merger and acquisition, knowledge is power. And transferring that knowledge so everybody is well informed is critical to the success. Taking time to explain the local nuances, intricacies of what it means to transact and transmit, what people may not know about currency conversion or repatriation of funds, what people may not know about invoicing, all of that is powerful to the company. And by sharing that knowledge, the local treasury team, the team that has been acquired, they really stand in a position to help and to support and stress the importance of why they are critical to the role at the company versus saying, we don't want to do it your way. It's really about finding this compromise through education, through learnings, and through knowledge.
Your experience, do companies go through each step that we just described? They first, like, you know, tip their toe in, they're like, This is nice water here. There is good business to be done. Then they start developing organically. the reason you would potentially go from organic to M&A is because it's not going as fast as you'd like, or there are some constraints that you didn't consider, and then you switch to M&A. Or people just go like, hey, we want to go into those 10 jurisdictions. We're going to buy a company that is present in these 10 jurisdictions, and we're just going to do business. How do they typically approach this? Just so treasurer listening to us right now have an idea of like, okay, I should prepare mainly for M&A, of course, in communication with your leadership team, or it's natural to go from tipping the toe, organic, and then M&A. How do this typically happen?
There is no typical path. Sorry, that's a bit of a boring answer. Corporates take different tacks and approaches based on their overlying strategy. Observations over the years would suggest that most multinational companies sell or source internationally. So if we look at the broad range of multinational companies, starting at, you know, 10 to 50 million, all the way up to a billion to 2 billion. On the lower end of that curve, you could find about 30% of corporates are moving money in and out of their host country. That means they could be selling abroad, they could be sourcing goods abroad. As you move up that continuum to more complex multinationals, what you find is 80 to 90% of them have some aspect of their business outside of the US. And they've done that, or out of their home country, and they've done that strategically to drive revenue, to diversify risk, and to be more global and competitive in the marketplace.
When we talk about internationalization, international business, lately we can't help but think about tariffs as well. Right. So this is a bit of a jump, but I feel there is a link between, hey, if you're developing globally, you should also be aware that tariffs. How are tariffs currently impacting treasury teams, especially in a global expansion setup, from what you can see, Sue?
We're not experts at tariffs. We do help clients navigate with advice and guidance, but particularly in the current market, no one can anticipate the outcomes. I want to start by saying that change is constant. This year, it might be tariffs. In 2026 or 2030, it could be something totally different. So as a business, it's critically important to take a longer view, a view of multiple business cycles, because there'll always be uncertainty, whether that's driven by tariffs or interest rate or geopolitical shifts or regulatory changes. So what is key for a corporate to really keep in mind is predicting for the unpredictable. So as we think about forward-looking conversations and not reactionary ones, it's important to think about, how does cost volatility impact your business? Will tariffs have a cost on imported goods? Will they impact how you can sell? Will they have a compressioning effect on your margins? As you think about tariffs, scenario modeling, right? How do you do stress testing and think about that impact on cash flow? Think about that impact on FX exposure. All of that will give you the agility that you need and the foresight that you need to help navigate any volatile market. And again, it could be tariffs or it could be something totally different.
Risk managers, after all. So anything can happen and we need to be ready for it. What best practices or supports does Bank of America provide and implement with its clients to ensure the best support to the business in that context of tariff, and potentially even in the context of tariff in international expansions?
Well, the first is thinking about cost volatility. What is that cost volatility going to do to impact your bottom line? The second would be really understanding FX volatility, and is there any repatriation risk? What tensions will trigger currency instability, maybe complicating FX exposures, whether that's natural hedging, whether that's FX strategies, thinking about predicting for exchange rate movements, right? How can you put in a proactive approach so that you can lock in a price regardless of what that FX currency movement is? And I think the other thing to really understand is, will a tariff create a disruption to a payment cycle? So suppliers might be thinking about shortening their payment terms. They might be demanding upfront payments to offset their own tariff exposure. All of these strains will put an impact on working capital. They could require additional liquidity buffers. So ensuring that you have enough corporate liquidity on hand is truly important during volatile times.
One thing I would like to ask you about too, because there is one term, one buzzword that we cannot avoid in any treasury conversation. It's AI and Gen AI specifically. So let's maybe start broad and at the top. How is Bank of America using AI and or Gen AI internally or externally to support its clients?
All right, I'm going to start with externally first. So externally, we have several cutting edge, leading innovative solutions that help our clients tap into AI as they think about improving their workflow. Before I do that, I think it's important to say smart people consume a lot of information. They read a lot. They're intellectually curious. What AI does is just speed up that process. So when we think about AI, what we're really solving for is, how do you consume a lot of information and how do you get that information into the fingertips of a key decision maker sooner, faster, in a more relevant way? Okay. So one corporate pain point that I think has persisted for decades is cash forecasting. And how do you accurately forecast cash around the world? Embedded in our Cash Pro platform is a module called Cash Pro Forecasting. And it essentially allows a corporate to use machine learning to automate and learn from historical cash flows to improve the accuracy of the forecast. So it automates the forecasting process, it saves times, it allows staff to focus on other strategic objectives. So how does it do that? First, it gives you real-time cash positioning. You can, within seconds, and provide immediate visibility to cash flow around the world. It taps into multi-bank reporting if there are third-party bank accounts and provides a comprehensive view of those cash positions. Then it customizes the cash forecast based on categories and cash flow of accounts and currencies and transaction types. It allows the user to, as I mentioned earlier, from a data standpoint, to tap into aligning those scenarios to different buckets and categories. And then through machine learning, it learns and it processes in scenario planning. What it's really allowed corporates to do is take cash forecasting off of an Excel spreadsheet and to put it in a more purposeful tool. So that's an easy one. It saved a ton of time for our corporates as we think through things like alerts when accounts are over or predetermining what an account balance should be if you want a trigger, you want to make a money movement. So I'll say that's first. Corporates in general have historically really struggled with forecasting. And this is one AI-generated tool that allows us to improve that process. Another one is our intelligent receivables solution. And if I think about the intelligent receivables solution, what has happened over time as we have moved away from paper. If a paper check comes in, it's relatively easy to match it against the invoice that it got sent with. But as we've moved to more digital environment, by tapping into AI, by tapping into machine learning, it allows us to take the payment information and the associated remittance detail of various payments coming from different channels and sources and sectors and match these two together. There are incredible benefits with intelligent receivables. We've allowed corporates to get to higher straight-through reconciliation rates. We've minimized the number of exceptions that have to be researched. We've helped improve day sales outstanding. And We've improved their customer experience because there's fewer manual tasks with that reconciliation. So as soon as the payment gets paid, the customer gets a timely and accurate matching of their outstanding invoice. For corporates, the automation, the efficiency, the data-driven insights, and the fact that the platform is available globally in different languages and clearing platforms and currencies and time zones, it's had a very significant impact on the way our corporates do business. And again, a second use point of where corporates have historically been challenged in applying cash to an outstanding invoice.
Walk us through a case study of the issue. Like, where have you seen AI make a noticeable impact for the treasury operations? Like, and we can anonymize, of course, no problem with that. I mean, everybody trusts Bank of America, like it's an established brand. But do you have something specific that we can go through to, like, hey, this is how, you know, cash flow forecasting and intelligent receivables has helped a client of ours, and here are the qualitative and quantitative benefits that they got out of it?
I'll give you a client use case on both, if that's okay. If I think about cash pro forecasting, I will give you an example of a cloud computing company that focuses on the pharmaceutical and life sciences industries. They were struggling with their ability to download transaction data into an Excel spreadsheet on a weekly basis. Not only was this cumbersome, but in many cases, it was manual as people around the company were keying data into the system. What CashPro Forecasting allowed our clients to do is to tap into the transactional activity that was in CashPro, right? Both incoming and outgoing payments, and automatically populate the system so that this information didn't have to be manually exported, and it saved several hours from an already resource-constrained treasury team in what was a very onerous process. The company now has better visibility. They're able to think more strategically about their cash, and they're able to deploy that cash in a way in which was never possible previously. So that's cash flow forecasting. When I flip and I think about our Bank of America Intelligent Receivables solution and the cash application process, I will tap into a very large manufacturing facility that was at a matching rate of about 60%, which meant that 40% of their incoming collections had to be touched by a representative on their AR team. Okay. This was for a variety of reasons. It was because their distribution group was selling invoices through to several big outlets that were combining invoices into a single payment. So you might end up with 10 invoices that were coming through in a single transaction. And what 10 invoices, right, did that payment entail? The second challenge that they had was there were deductions in the process. There were damaged goods. So if you were selling 100 widgets, and only 95 made it through the shipment in a meticulous, perfect way, the company that was paying the invoice was deducting those off of the top. And so what Intelligent Receivables allowed us to do is to tap into the deductions at the corporate level and to think through what is the invoice matching and to just do it at an accelerated pace. After we implemented Intelligent Receivables, and after we worked on the mapping process, we got them to over 95% matching on their invoice rate. So 60 to 95. And what I think is really important is the resources that were doing that function, they were able to get redeployed in the company doing higher value work. So it was a win for everybody.
I'm thinking about our discussion at the very beginning, 50 million to 2 billion. Like this is a wide range. How would you recommend middle market firms first start with AI, especially those with potentially limited resources? Is so cash flow forecasting and intelligent receivables something that any client of Bank of America can access? Where should they begin, right? Is that the right thing? Cash flow forecasting, I would tend to say yes, especially if you're expanding internationally. But like from your point of view, Sue, where would you start if you were a middle market firm with limited resources when it comes to AI?
Well, I would start small, and I would start with maybe one or two use cases with a clear ROI. I would think about where that AI can have the biggest impact. And I'll give you a very simple example at Bank of America. So we have a repository of technical information for our associates. And we are now using Gen AI in a solution called Ask Global Payment Solutions, or fondly known internally as Ask GPS, to tap into that information and to go through thousands and thousands of documents to within a second to get the technical information that our associates need. And that same type of Gen AI functionality could be deployed at a corporate level to think about things such as policy governance, or potentially to think about timesheet governance or swipes to timesheets. It could be used for a number of use cases. I think the good news is for corporates, there is a lot of technology that is on the street. I just would suggest a word of caution. Due diligence is critically important. As you think about bringing AI into your corporate firewalls, the partnership with your tech team, with your infrastructure team, making sure that it's compliant and making sure that it is safe is going to be critical. And that's one of the reasons that our corporates look to Bank of America is we've gone through that robust governance process for them, right? So when we tap into the technology, it's already hit our sniff test and our test for being innovative before we think about solutioning it out to the many corporates that we do business with.
I like that a lot. So this was an absolute masterclass on global expansion and how to approach it from a treasury standpoint. Anything that I didn't ask you that you'd maybe like to say to the treasury teams who are going through this process or are getting ready to go through this process that we didn't tackle and you think is important?
I guess I would just say it's fun. Like, I don't know why I haven't said that earlier, but expanding outside of your home country is fun. It gives you a chance to expand your knowledge, to learn about countries and cultures and jurisdictions. It gives you the opportunity to connect with people that maybe you normally wouldn't cross paths with on a vacation or as part of your daily workflow. So embrace it. One of the things or the mottos that I've always lived by is life is an accumulation of your experiences. It's the things that you, it's the places you go, the people you meet, and the things you learn along the way. And whether you're doing that personally or whether you're doing that professionally, I truly believe, and it was one of the ways that I started at Bank of America, is thinking about how do you network with colleagues and teammates and partners beyond the borders of your home country.
I was going to keep that off record, but since you're mentioning it, Sue, I've interviewed lots of people on Corporate Treasury 101, and I love all my guests, don't get me wrong. But we see and we feel that you're passionate about this. And it's so cool to see. Like, you find it fun, so that's what you just mentioned, but we feel that you love that topic. You talk about it with passion, so that was a really, really, really nice interview. Thank you so much for coming on Corporate Treasury 101. If people want to find out more about you, about CashPro, about intelligent receivables, or overall Bank of America solution, where should they go?
We have a wealth of knowledge on the Bank of America website for corporates. So I would direct anybody that wants to learn more to that website. It not only has a full description of our solution offerings, there's case studies, there is a link and a request portal if you want to get more information. And nothing would make me happier than having one of my associates reach out and to provide a wealth of information.
Amazing. We'll put all the links in the description. Sue, thank you so much for coming on Corporate Treasury 101.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.